listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, as always, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host and co-DM.
That's right, McGill.
It is the 28th of November, 2023, and we are recording episode 171?
That's right.
Right. And, man, what do we got for a show today? I've got, we've been hyping up for some time over the course of these episodes. I've been covering Coyote's Aegis and talking about how they were getting set for the Battle of Ashgrain Outpost. Well, today it begins in earnest.
Oh boy.
The Battle of Ashgrain Outpost, the fight to retake or to take control, to invade or liberate the slave-driven industrial breadbasket of Agaloc.
And it sounds like you're not concerned in the same way that you have been lately that this is going to be too combat heavy.
I mean, it's just it's a big battle. What am I supposed to say? Like, it's not just a one individual combat. Obviously, there's going to be a whole bunch of combat going on, but you know, this is sort of the main event. I think is what I'm really trying to say is, like, for a while now we've been doing encounters and things that just lead up to this larger battle. We've been gathering forces and all that, taking out key objectives. But now,
and I always do the check-in like this, but since this is a big event in the campaign, is this the end of an act?
No.
Nope.
They still gotta take the mantle after this.
All right. But I don't know, you know, that's the kind of thing you might split them up. This might be the end of one act, then the mantle's the end of the next. I don't know, man.
Not me.
I don't get to see your outline.
This act is the Agaloc act, and we're going to be done with Agaloc when it's done with. So we're going to be finishing with the battle of the mantle. But, yeah, for now, we've got an outpost in the way. What about you, McGill? What have you brought?
Well, I got another little sampler platter of stuff. Just want to mention a couple of RPG news items, just RPG things that are in the news. I guess this is two reviews that popped up in my feed recently, talking about the RPG based on the comic series Die. I read a review for that, and it is, of course, out for sale.
My fellow tester of teeth, Kieran Gillen.
Oh, I didn't realize Kieran Gillen was also testing teeth. That's great. And then also, because it was Cyber Monday, I got this pop-up from Polygon that listed a bunch of new-ish, like new since last year, expansions for Everyday Heroes. Everyday Heroes being the reboot of D20 Modern, which I've talked about in the distant past on this show. And then there was a crowdfunding campaign for Everyday Heroes last year. It got funded. And then once that came out, they've released a bunch of different expansions that are all based on movies. Play D20 Modern, but with a flavor of these specific films. So I was just want to talk about a few of those. And as if that wasn't enough, Tom, I have a two-page RPG that I want to cover in the Danger Room that I think will appeal to you, and you might be skeptical with this title. I can't tell. It's a very Tom title. The RPG is Goblin with a Fat Ass.
Yeah, I heard about that. You told me that this was coming up, and I don't know what to think of it. We'll see. I guess we'll see.
So it's funny because with that title, I can already see, like, Tom's interest peak and then wane. Where Goblin, oh, interested with a fat ass? Like, sounds like a joke, right? But I guess the real joke is that I think this is actually a workable RPG and not just a gag.
I don't know. The fact that you said workable instead of, like, good or something, I think says
well,
a
I
lot.
Need... I need to play it, but we'll talk about it later. You'll see what I mean. I think you might be on board for this, Tom. This might even be one of those RPG systems that you insist on trying out.
You know what? While we are talking about news,
let's just do all the news.
Well, no, I just want to throw in, and this occurred to me last time, but I didn't bring it up, is I think that the biggest news in role-playing games right now is, have you heard about, they did Pathfinder 2nd Edition Remastered.
Right, this is the edition they put out, separate from the OGL, right? Is this the one that they're putting out that is like distancing themselves from that whole mess?
That's definitely one of the things that's going on. One of the big things about the remaster is a lot of things have had their terms just changed to be less sharing with pre-existing D&D terms. Yeah. Although it's funny, I feel like one of them was actually... they changed flat-footed, which I always think of as a distinctly Pathfinder condition.
Huh. Interesting. I haven't had a chance to look over any... I mean, I'm still pretty unfamiliar with the Pathfinder system as a whole. I know a lot of people really like it, but I've never actually played Pathfinder proper. And I haven't had a chance to look at this new edition either. Have you glanced at it, or...
In Pathfinder...
Any remarks beyond flat-footed?
In Pathfinder 2E, a flat-footed character is one caught off guard. Wait, no, I think I'm reading the wrong thing. Oh, well.
I mean, I would say that that's maybe a better term, more understandable term for an inexperienced player. Caught off guard.
Yeah, I don't know. All that to say that, you know, big things happening in Pathfinder, and I feel like, you know, this is one of the big shakeups that is happening, is that people who are playing second edition Pathfinder suddenly have these new changes thrust upon them, which I don't know. Generally, I've gotten the vibe that Pathfinder, like, knows what it's doing, so we'll see.
Yeah, for sure, and obviously, it remains to be seen, but it sure seems like 2023 was not a great year for D&D, and also just, like, Hasbro, what would you call them, games shop games? Like, Magic the Gathering is also in a weird place, too, where it seems like Hasbro is trying to make a ton of money off of these particular games, that they don't really know what to do with them, and of course there have been all those scandals that we've talked about in the past, and this new edition of Pathfinder, part of it does seem to be in response to the whole open gaming license scandal that Wizards of the Coast was causing a stir about, and all of this has me wondering, like, has D&D peaked? Are we seeing D&D, you know, sort of dropping in the RPG charts a bit as people move towards things like Pathfinder or systems like Blades in the Dark or anything like that?
I think it's very interesting to note that, you know, for me, 5e, the thing that they had consistently been nodding towards but then not actually following through on was Planescape. They kept making references Planescape stuff and sort of implying that they were going to do it at some point, but then they kept having release after release where they did not do it. Now they have done it. They have, and it feels very break glass in case of emergency, and behind that glass is like the Planescape setting. But I haven't really heard much about it. I've heard, in fact, most of what I've heard has been like, you know, pretty casual dismissal of like, oh, it's just like watered down Planescape. It's like the new Planescape, it doesn't have all the charm that the original Planescape had, which is great. Also crazy to me because they did some promotional videos with Brennan Lee Mulligan, the main dungeon master for Dimension 20, all him just talking about how much he loved Planescape. Huh. I feel like that was just supposed to get people hype about Planescape, especially if they didn't know about it. But I don't think that it has had the success for 5e that one would hope that it would. But maybe I'm wrong. This is just my perception as a bystander.
Yeah, I guess there's sort of a lot of that here where, you know, all my perception is I'm even more of a bystander than you. I'm definitely not hooked into like things like Dimension 20. I don't watch Critical Role. I don't listen to The Adventure Zone. So I'm kind of behind the times when it comes to pop RPGs. But are there like, you know, it makes me wish that there were charts like there are for like the Billboard, you know, top 20 songs or something, where you can sort of see what the status of each of these RPGs are. What's the new hotness? What are people favoring? Is Planescape even on the chart at all?
There used to be a great podcast called RPG Countdown, but that used to be just what you're describing. But I don't think they've had an episode in a long time.
Ah, dang it.
But yeah, you know what was funny? I used to listen to RPG Countdown. Back when the big thing making a big splash was Fiasco, but at the time there were still fourth edition products that were ranking very high in the sales. And I feel like that is always kind of going to be a general rule, is like, even though we may perceive D&D as having kind of fallen off, I think that they have like a consistent sales base that like,
well, they're still like they're still the best known, and I feel like sort of the best, the most popular by default in that way. But like I know I've said it at some point on the podcast before, but literally saying Dungeons and Dragons, it's sort of synonymous with just role playing games, right? Like if somebody's like, "Are you playing D&D?" But in fact, you're playing Everyday Heroes. You might just be like, "Yep," because it kind of means the same thing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, what interests me in amidst all of this, especially after this weird year for Wizards of the Coast, Hasbro, D&D, what it just interests me is like the favor of the people who like the public faces of RPGs. One of the reasons I wonder is D&D's popularity starting to wane a bit is you know, we've already listed a few of these actual play shows, The Adventure Zone, Dimension 20, Critical Role. What system do they play on Dimension 20? Is that 5e?
Almost exclusively 5e. Like, I think that whenever it's Brennan Lee Mulligan, it is 5e that they're running. They've had a few seasons and like side quests that have used other systems, but I think those have always had other DMs. I think that Brennan Lee Mulligan is pretty committed to translating anything that he does into 5e. I could be
fair,
wrong about
fair.
That. Like, I know that everything from like Tiny Heist to Unsleeping City to everything was like 5e. I can say, like, as an example, one of the side quests that they did that was run by Gabe Hicks, Shriek Week, which is like monster dating sim set at a university. That one, Gabe introduced his own system called the Mythic System that was, I mean, really, it's World of Darkness with some numbers changed. It's like you roll a pool of D10s and then you're looking for 7 or higher, which generally that's what World of Darkness is like, except you're looking for 8s or higher in my experience with World of Darkness. But all that to say, yeah, Dimension 20 sometimes uses a different system, but I think when it's Brennan Lee Mulligan, it's always 5e.
Mostly 5e. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I might not have my facts straight here, but Critical Role just has their own system now, right? This candle, what's it called?
Oh, Candela Obscura. I thought that was like a whole new thing.
Yeah, that's a new thing. But it like isn't that their own system, their in-house system that they've made?
Like for one season, I don't think that they're going to start using that for their Dungeons and Dragons games.
Ah, interesting. The point that I'm trying to get at is I was just thinking like
Candela Obscura had like a very specific sort of like Lovecraftian investigator vibe to it for me, I thought.
The point I'm trying to get at, though, the root of me questioning D&D's popularity is these are three of the biggest actual play shows on right now, and how many of them are playing D&D is my question, because I know they go through phases. Really, most of them now? I feel like for a while there, it was like Adventure Zone was doing Blades in the Dark, there was Candela Obscura. And if that's the case, then like two out of the three biggest actual plays aren't even playing D&D. Does that mean anything or not? I don't know.
I don't really know what's going on with Critical Role. Like, I don't know. I got the vibe that Candela Obscura was just like sort of a season among others.
You might be right. The reason it's on my mind is among the RPG news articles I've been reading, they're selling Candela Obscura, right? Like you can buy source books for that. So I've been seeing a lot of that around. Do we want to talk about the other two little news items I brought, since we're talking about news?
Yeah, sure, why not?
So, Everyday Heroes, the core rulebook was on sale on Cyber Monday, but I found out about too late. Is it still on sale right now? It might be. I might have to pick this up. No, it's not. This article popped up on Polygon, listing all of these scenarios from Evil Genius that are all just modules meant to be played with Everyday Heroes. And because I am an old fan of D20 Modern, I figured I'd just list some of these off. And maybe the question to ask you, Tom, get your reaction, is like, would you play an RPG in this setting? Does this setting appeal to you? Escape from New York.
Just generally?
Yeah, that's what it is. Escape from New York, a cinematic adventure for the Everyday Hero system.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'd be interested if somebody said that they were going to be running Everyday Heroes. It's not something that I like want to rush out and play right away. I mean, right now I'm pretty committed to Wicked Ones, so.
Oh, man, I mean, Wicked Ones, I'm sure we're going to talk about that. I don't know about if we'll talk about it on this episode, but we're definitely going to talk about it in the future because we just started off and I'm having a blast. But no, my question here is like, okay, Tom, I say to you, hey, I'm running a campaign of Everyday Heroes and the setting is Escape from New York. Do you want to play that?
Yeah, if you were going to run that game, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, what if I was running Everyday Heroes and the setting is The Crow?
So I'm a bit more skeptical on this one.
That's what I figured.
But maybe?
It's like, are you all crows?
Yeah, that's such a, like, yeah, exactly. What's the thing?
Here's one that might appeal more. Pacific Rim.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I always felt like, you know, I thought Pacific Rim was fine, but I never got into it the way other people seem to get into it. Like, some people seem to really love Pacific Rim. More shame for them when the sequel came out, as I understand it.
Oh, the sequel's so bad.
But, I don't know. I guess I'd be down to try out some Pacific Rim. Likely than The Crow.
Yeah, you can really sort of see how each of these might lend itself to an RPG. Like Escape from New York, it has a distinct aesthetic and a setting that you know. You are in the walled, lawless city of New York, and presumably everybody who plays, like you're either playing as some special ops agent who's been sent in, or you're playing as one of the kind of Mad Max-esque gang members who live in the New York prison. Makes sense. Pacific Rim, that makes sense too. I imagine it would favor an even number of players, since in that world,
yeah, you I was need about to say, is everybody two people have to operate drift a mech with them? That's I don't know about that. That seems whack to me.
I mean, you could probably also have it be that, like, each player who's a mecha pilot, a Jaeger pilot, has an NPC buddy. I'd probably allow that. I don't see any problem with that. How about this neck? Oh, and the crow, you just go like, huh?
Kind of.
Maybe the idea behind that is that everyone, they're all investigators, and they're investigating the crimes committed by the crow.
Yeah. Well, that sounds a bit boring. I don't know.
What about Highlander?
Yeah, been a while since I touched anything Highlander related, but
surprisingly, not a solo RPG.
Yeah. Yeah.
That this is one where it's like, unless you're playing a Highlander, what's the point? But if you are playing a Highlander, does every campaign end with a giant PvP fight?
I don't know, man.
Kong Skull Island.
This that could be fun.
Yep. That much like Escape from New York, it suggests a setting and a type of character or type of monster, maybe, without, like, I don't remember the names of any of the characters in Kong Skull Island. So you could just be anybody. That makes sense. And finally, Total Recall.
You know, none of these excite me in the way that I would expect to be excited by an Everyday Heroes game, you know?
Really? Okay.
I'll be honest. I don't think, like, I don't know.
You'd rather do your own thing than play in this prefab playground, eh?
Maybe. I don't know. Escape from New York could be cool. But yeah, I guess the thing is, this is also probably informed by the fact that, like, I just fairly recently ran Boots on the Ground, which was sort of my take on a modern RPG setting experience. And yeah, that was very much like I wanted to have my own setting and my own thing. Although it didn't really work out for me, so I don't know.
So you don't really know, like, is it the fact that these are existing movies, like this is branded content, right? Is that the thing that sort of makes you go like, eh? Like, why would I play Pacific Rim and not just create my own world of mechas and kaiju?
Yeah, I think that's more, or at least there are, like, mecha and kaiju settings that are more interesting to me.
Hmm.
And yeah, I was thinking about, like along the lines of the Escape from New York one, like, what about, like, a Mad Max one? And I was like, even that is just kind of like, I don't have a particular amount of connection to, like, the wastelands depicted in those movies, you know? I don't
interesting
see that and
okay
go like, man, I want to live there.
Well, no, but I mean,
man, we just recently watched Escape from or Beyond Thunderdome, and, like, so much of that movie is just Mad Max getting dicked around. Like, it's almost,
I mean,
the entire film is just like, oh, god damn it, now I gotta deal with this. And I feel like, I don't know, there's something about that that doesn't really, like, inspire me to make an RPG, because it feels so much like it could just be, like, freeform, like, just throw some tropes together, you know?
I guess. I mean, I ran a post-apocalyptic RPG, so
that's
obviously I connect with the setting. I don't know. It's interesting hearing you say, like none of these really grab me. But what would grab you, Tom? Is there a movie that, if there was a module, you'd be into it?
So I was trying to think about this, and, like, the thing is, I'm pretty sure there is an Alien game, like an Alien RPG.
Yeah, yeah, I know there is, for sure.
Which,
it's in my bookmarks as one we might look at in the future.
Yeah, Aliens really jumped out at me when I was thinking about like movies and stuff. It's funny because RoboCop came to mind, but then I was like, I don't know if I'd actually really want to play RoboCop.
Well, that's another one, almost like The Crow, where it's like, unless you're playing as that character, what's the point?
Yeah, but it's also the fact that the setting is just kind of miserable.
RoboCop is especially miserable. That like the fun stuff about the setting is all the like the news broadcasts and stuff. It's definitely not how the future looks. The future looks just like a miserable concrete city where nothing nice ever happens.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, it's a funny thing. Like, I definitely imagine it more as its own RPG, but like, you know, I think my top fandom still is Madness. There was a Madness RPG, and like, Madness Project Nexus, the game has so much like RPG DNA to it in its background that like, I don't know. There are times when I'm really like, why am I not just like playing a Madness game, you know?
Interesting.
But
I only have the most passing experience with it the few times I played with you.
yeah, and even then, it's like I don't know that much about the storyline of the Madness game, and that's sort of like a trick, is that like setting wise and fandom wise, I am very attracted to everything that Madness has going on, but then in terms of making my own story with it, I am not even sure I'd know where to start.
This is interesting. This is interesting to me. Just sort of zeroing in on what appeals to Tom versus what appeals, or what doesn't appeal to Tom. So it's not necessarily the brand, the fact that these are pre-existing settings. It really is just like looking at the setting and going like, eh, I guess that's fine.
Yeah, I think so. I think like, you know, ideally when I look at a setting, I want to be really excited or like really excited by the concept of the game. You know, Wicked Ones kind of did that for me. Fleshscape has done that for me. A friend showed me a pretty crazy looking game recently. I think it's called Extreme Meat Punks Forever.
Well, that sounds awesome.
So as I understand it, this is a world where oh, it's like a game as well as an RPG, I think. Or is it an RPG even? I thought it was an RPG.
There's an RPG that's being kickstarted.
Oh yeah, okay. There we go. Yeah. So you are in a world, as I understand it, very similar to Fleshscape. It's like everything in the world is like the corpses of dead gods, basically.
Is this another
Yeah.
one by Kieran Gillen?
Is
No.
it?
No. Sorry, Kieran Gillen just blurbed it. The right underneath Welcome to Meat World, it says, "If only there was a game that had big disaster queer emotions and gave you a giant meat suit to kill Nazis, with Extreme Meat Punks Forever, you don't have to choose."
Yeah.
That's the Kieran Gillen review.
Meat there, it's called Meat Worlders. They became skilled in the act of meat allergy, bending the forces of nature to their will. It does have big
Oh, it's a Powered by the Apocalypse game.
yeah, it does have big Fleshscape energy, I will say, but you know, what was I just saying? I guess I was saying
Does this
that
setting appeal to you?
Fleshscape, kind of, yeah. It's sort of like the at least the whole thing. Like I say, Fleshscape appealed to me. I think that this appeals to me on the same level, basically, right?
Right. Okay. So
Really out there.
final question on this subject then. What was it about G.I. Joe that appealed to you?
So this was interesting because I think that initially, I was pretty excited by the general sort of like cartoon world system that you had presented to me with Essence 20. And initially it started as like, well, which of these do I want to play? And when I started getting into them, like G.I. Joe, sort of, I like it because it simultaneously appeals to that, like, hey, we've got a new cartoon sort of 5e-ish system. But at the same time, G.I. Joe had, like, it was, like, a very defined system that had, like, a lot of things to it that appealed to me, like the gear creation and the character building and everything. Like, it, in truth, it's not that far off from 5e, but I was just kind of, and, you know, I think that G.I. Joe as a setting is much more open than any of the settings we talked about previously. Like, a G.I. Joe adventure can happen anywhere in the world, and I can have Cobra doing basically anything. And so that, like, the customizability, I think, really jumps out at me.
Okay. Fair. Yeah, I mean, if nothing else, like, G.I. Joe, more so even than the other ones from Essence 20. Like, there was, My Little Pony and Power Rangers. Were those the other two?
Yeah, and Transformers.
More so than My Little Pony and Power Rangers, G.I. Joe really has the potential for, like, huge range of character possibilities. Like, that's really the whole thing about G.I. Joe, is
that's
that there's
the thing
so
that
many.
Really jumped out at me is, like, you know, Power
and I guess
Rangers.
Transformers is similar in that way, but Power Rangers and MLP not quite as much.
Power Rangers and Transformers, for me, the trick was that your character type always kind of boiled down to, I am a thing that transforms into a different
right.
thing, you know? Like, yeah. Power Rangers, it's like it all comes down to once you morph. Like, your character build is always basically a character that morphs to get special abilities. And while there obviously are differences in that, I felt that G.I. Joe was just a lot more fun to tinker with because it was very, like, open-ended.
That's fair. But then why not, I'm about to answer my own question, I was going to say, but then why not just create your own G.I. Joe RPG instead of playing the branded setting? But you basically did with Boots on the Ground, right?
Yeah, kind of.
Or Going Commando, for that matter.
Yeah, I don't know.
Anyway.
Going Commando was sort of also just like a Caltrop core experiment, so.
So bottom line is that while I have nostalgic love for Everyday Heroes, Tom is not that into it, and certainly not that into any of these movie setting modules that have come out in the wake of its release.
You know what I'd play?
What?
Men in Black.
Ooh, hey, that is a good one.
Men in Black as a setting for Everyday Heroes, I would be down for that. That would be sick.
Yeah, I think that is a good call. I'm not going to look into it now, but maybe there is a Men in Black module for Everyday Heroes anyway.
I suspect that at the very least, you know, so I've probably shouted them out before, but there's a website, Mr. Gon's Character Sheets, that creates, it's like a repository mostly for character sheets for World of Darkness. But this guy has all these different character sheets, PDFs, editable, non-editable, etc., printer-friendly, all different versions of all these different character sheets for all these different games, tons of different character sheets for Vampire, like if you want your character sheet to be branded with your specific clan and have like a specific aesthetic to it, they got you covered for that. But also, they have on the website a number of character sheets for homebrew games that people had asked him to, or asked Mr. Gon to specifically make them a sheet for their game that was like World of Darkness based or something like that. And so there are definitely, I don't know about Men in Black, but there is definitely a like homebrew
World of
Darkness based The Matrix character sheet out there. There's one for Star Wars, I think. Yeah. There's definitely, at the very least, there are artifacts to help you if you wanted to go that direction.
I should say that in the original D20 Modern game, built into it, D20 Modern was kind of like Shadowrun, but in the modern
here
day.
Here we go. I was just looking at Mr. Gon's site, and sheets for his custom games includes Men in Black, Star Wars Jedi Knights, The Matrix, and Sin City.
Oh, Sin City. Interesting. I wonder what, like, Sin City is all about just the dialogue and the imagery. I wonder what the game would be like.
Yeah, he's also got sheets I've made for others' custom games, include Kill Bill. Resident Evil. There is a Highlander one here. There's a game here called Jackass the Suffering. Yeah. Gotham Knights, Gotham's Finest.
I feel like a Jackass RPG would be similar to Tune.
Yeah.
But yeah, what I was going to say is the original D20 Modern source book did have, what were they called? Section 13, I think it was. They're basically the Men in Black. It had its own sort of built-in Men in Black with the setting. So I would not at all be surprised if there was an official Everyday Heroes published Men in Black module. And then, yeah, the other thing that had come up in my feed, I'll just go over it quickly, but the RPG for the comic Die by Kieran Gillen. This is a Kieran Gillen episode. Kieran Gillen popping up everywhere. I can't remember. Tom, did you read Die?
I started to, and then I got distracted by something that I didn't finish it, so.
Man, it's so good. I know. I want to reread it. So I find it very interesting that they've made an official RPG for it, and this review, which I found on tabletopgaming.co.uk, is extremely positive, with the caveat that the people who like this the most will be seasoned role players. Like, the appeal of this is that you are playing the unusual RPG that is not quite D&D that they play in the comic of Die. And then on top of that, there are like meta mechanics, because of course in the comic, who the people are, who the players are in the real world, is different. Like, it's like Jumanji, right? They're real people, and then they go into the game and they become their characters. So the RPG includes some meta stuff like that. And I'll just read little excerpts from this so that I don't get anything wrong. Each player is given a single die and a specific character style. The character styles are called paragons. These include concepts like the dictator, who gets a d4 and can manipulate or command the emotions of other people with devastating effect. The fool, who wields a d6, survives on the wavetips of innate luck, swashbuckling their way through the world and being punished if they ever take anything too seriously. These are very reflective of the characters in the comics. Over the course of the game, you'll uncover the heart of the setting, which is the Nightmare Realm. It is here you'll find a means of connecting to every creative story ever told, including the one that you are all playing. The GM... here you could be stopped by your GM, who is in turn game mastering as Mary Shelley, who may set Frankenstein's monster upon you, an NPC that might not actually be entirely under their control. It says here, the whole concept is intensely meta, filled with references to other games, systems, and common story fiction. But the bottom line, of course, is Die is not for everybody. It's perfect for the right group. Now, there's this other thing here The core mechanic is not D&D. It's a D6 dice pool system where a 4 or more is a success and difficulty dictated by how many successes you need. Similar to the Year Zero system, but with added complexity and a little more nuance. The core system still lands firmly in easy-to-run lightweight territory with Paragon skills and everything else layered in, too. You need a game group prepared for complex emotions. This is interesting. Prepare for complex concepts. The dictator has the ability to overrule the emotions and actions of other players. There are safety mechanics discussed for this, but this could still be weird. The Fool's player will be literally scribbling on their physical D6, adding flukes and crosses to future rolls, cheekily handing their dice back to the GM when they do something without preparing, being penalized if they ever dare to plan properly. A game that relies on cheerful winks and sometimes intentionally irritating each other is novel, but perhaps not for the faint of heart. Let's see here. The first of several GM instruction sections acknowledges this, blah, blah, blah. Here we go. The introductory scenario is called Total Party Kill and features the players having to roleplay their own fictional pre-existing fraught relationship with the in-game GM. That's the introductory adventure. Obviously, it had the game itself. The package is great with awesome art. The book contains a big bestiary. These are all just sort of, you know, comments on how it's a nice product. And this reviewer gives it a big recommendation. This reviewer being, where's the person's name? Oh, I can't find it. I'll credit them when we post this eventually. But Chris Lowry. Chris Lowry reviewed this. So, Tom, does this one sound appealing to you?
Not particularly.
No?
Not really. I don't know about all that emotions and whatnot. Just messing with each other.
Hey, now.
I don't know. I guess I'd probably get into the... I probably get the joke, but... I don't know if I'd enjoy it that much to play.
Yeah, you know, it's almost like, well, I say that, but you literally just said you aren't that into it, but it almost feels like an RPG designed to be played by a group of GMs, like people who have already run lots of RPGs. It seems like that's kind of the audience that it's made for, not necessarily people who haven't even GM'd, because you have to consider all of these different weird meta mechanics on top of it. I don't know. I'd certainly give it a shot. This is another one. We should have a rating system on this show where we sort of rate things like this, because this definitely falls into the category where Everyday Heroes was falling for you, which is like, I'd play this if someone else was running it. And in this case, I do love the setting. Like, I think the comic is super cool, and this has the potential to be really interesting. For those who haven't read the comic, the whole reason that the GM in the RPG of Die can mess around is because the GM is an in-game character in the comic as well. Like, the person running the game is trapped in the game with all the other players, so... I see why they've set it up like that in the print RPG as well. So this intrigues me. I like the comic. I'd play it if someone else runs it. And is that sort of where you fall too, Tom? You'd play it if someone else ran it?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. It depends
The right group. If I ran it. Oh, you know, that's high praise. Thank you. If I did it, Tom would play it. Let's hop over to Coyote's Aegis.
All right. Well, let's say So when we left off, the party had just rescued they'd broken into the prison camp in Ashgrain Outpost. They managed to liberate not only the bronze shadow dragon known as Cub, but also a supply truck driver by the name of Val, who helped them roll on out of that prison camp up one of the sort of like quarry ramps out of Ashgrain Outpost. And when they return to the Draelic encampment to the northeast, they have enough time for a long rest before the battle begins. This poses the same risks as before as far as taking a long rest in Egglock goes, the risk of, you know, magical madness as a result of long resting in the forest. They'll have just enough time to enjoy one of Hex's meals before they take part in the big offensive. In the meantime, they check in with Morgar to notify him of their success. Morgar is visibly relieved, though his mind is firmly set on the upcoming assault. Morgar is able to direct those drow that accompanied the group to join with their fellow drow resistance members in the camp, and the same goes for the stone giants. Hex mentions Val's dedication to the cause to Morgar. Morgar makes a note of it. Commendations will have to wait for the time being, but when this is all over, I've got a lot of people to thank. Morgar gives a brief smile before heading off to deal with some more business around the camp. They can see Illithids rushing around, evidently another rest shift had just ended. They can hear scattered shouts, screams, laughter, crying, all sorts of madness breaking out in parts of the camp. Soldiers rush from place to place carrying the small metal containers used for treated brain caps. Jen says, would my Illithid friends know Drow? And Alex says, Drowish, Drowanese, Drowian, Drench?
Drench.
Yes, actually. Shortly after you speak to Morgar, Cub drifts down into the encampment with surprising grace and ease, as if the darkened trees of the forest do not obstruct its flight in any way. A hush falls over the camp, all eyes fixed on the dark and magnificent creature. Suddenly, without hesitation, Gog comes running out of the camp to hug the dragon around the neck. For a moment, the shadow dragon's intimidating demeanor cracks as Cub smiles at his reunion with Gog. Cub! Gog shouts happily. Hello, old friend, Cub says quietly. Gog lets go and looks at the dragon before saying, You got dark! Cub smiles and replies, You got clean. The ogre chuckles heartily. Don't hold that against me! If Gent seeks the aid of the Illithis in reading the Drow spellbook, they will ask that they wait a while for them to deal with most of the most recent batch of waking soldiers. After about 20 minutes, one of the Illithids seeks out Gent, asking how they can help. After reuniting with Cub, Gog finds Hex, who appears to be the most injured of the team. Cub says sorry for being so angry. They left him in a pocket shadow for ages. Gog offers Hex a greater healing potion. This means a lot to Gog. Thank you. Hey, no problem, big guy. Just glad I didn't have to shoot him. Hex is finishing up dressing a boar for roasting. Dent sees if the Illithids could use anything in the spellbook to aid them. And I provide the, I say it's a glossy black spider hide small travel size spell book. Gent currently has it, and it has the spells Sanctuary, Protection from Evil and Good, Web, Levitate, Darkness, Gaseous Form, Black Tentacles, Arcane Eye, Pass Wall, or Planar Binding. Connor says, looks pretty standard to me. And Jen asks, should I hold on to it? And Connor gives a little shrug and says, the armory might be interested, but I can't use it. I say, protection from evil and good might be useful in this battle, so if you give it to one of the drow or Illithids, they may be able to help somewhat. However, Jen might just as well hold on to it and then give it to her college or someone else from her tribe. Jen says, yeah, we'll probably just do that. I guess you can look at it this way. If there's a tactic you guys would like to pull during the battle using one of these spells, I'll allow it under the assumption that you give the book to a drow or Illithid spellcaster in the field during the battle, or beforehand. Like, if you have one as a big tactical idea for a pass wall or gaseous form, which is already used to get you into the forge earlier, for example, you put that into play by way of this book. Jen says, okay, can I keep that option then? Say, totally. You only lose it if you no longer have access to a spellcaster, a drow spellcaster or Illithid. Say, that's fair. I say, any spellcaster that can read it, really. But yeah, beyond that, we had a little break there before the long rest before the battle, but we'll just skip ahead to after that long rest. So, before taking their last long rest before the battle, they all get to enjoy fresh boar roast prepared by Hexakila. Good eating. They then have their final opportunity for a long rest before the battle, though the regular risks of taking a long rest in the Forest of Agaloc apply. They go ahead and take that long rest. Once again, their dreams are haunted by specters of giant multi-legged reptiles which stalk them through the forest. Shadowy dream behirs that scuttle suddenly out of the darkness to strike in a flash of crackling light. They must all make wisdom saving throws. Jake gets a 14, Hex gets a 7, and Connor gets a 20. This time, Hex is struck by sleep paralysis. He can neither move nor speak. He simply lies there, trapped between sleep and waking. Jen jokingly says, "We leave him." And then says, "I feel like we probably have a routine of checking on each other when we wake up now." Connor gives everybody a little shake in the morning. They discover that Hex is unresponsive upon shaking him. On finding Hex catatonic, Connor gives him a greater restoration, and Hex is cured of his state instantly.
Oh, when thank goodness up, they retrieved him from catatonia.
Ah, yeah, that's a good point. It's so far away from the battle. When they've gotten up, they have just enough time to prepare themselves for the battle and fill up on leftovers from last night's roast. Gent says, "Can I see where What's-Her-Face got to with the other freed slaves?" And I say, "Kat and the bulk of the slaves freed from the prison camp have joined the Drow resistance in the Draelic encampment." Gent says, "Oh, and did that dickhole who left came back? I'm keeping note of who's present." And I say, "The Drow that had been encouraging desertion until you fed him a brain cap has indeed kept his promise of returning with 25 or so additional Drow resistance fighters." Gent says,
Oh, that dickhole.
And I say, "At this point, the Drow resistance part of the camp is pretty large. Gent doesn't have to become a bounty hunter after this for deserters," Gent says. And I say, "By the time you finish eating, most of the army has begun breaking camp in preparation for the big push. It's not long before the first wave of Draelic soldiers begins their assault." Jen says, "Do we need to find someone to get orders?" I say, "You can check in with Morgwar for a final briefing before the battle. I'll summarize it with a little explanation of how the battle will work that I've prepared." So, they will encounter multiple objectives throughout the battle, such as participating in the initial charge on the front lines, and each one they complete, they'll receive a payment bonus for. Technically, these bonuses will be total and paid out after the battle, but I'll indicate the bonus after each completed objective, and you can basically add it to your sheet then and there. I think you'll get it as you get the prompts. For the time being, you're moving in along with the rest of your allies. It's go time. You've been able to tell just by looking at the map, but seeing the outpost sprawled out before you as you emerge from the forest with the army reminds you just how vast Ashgrain Outpost is. Though you couldn't necessarily estimate it, the outpost is in fact about 700 feet across and about 1,400 feet long at its widest and longest points in the trench. Tunnels and gates in the area rise to 30 feet, but the outpost is generally open to the smoggy sky above. Only sparse, withered trees have been allowed to grow within the entrenched perimeter of the outpost, which reach heights of only 5 to 10 feet. So here's the first example of one of those objectives I mentioned. The first wave marches into Ashgrain Outpost in a dense mass of red cloaks. Those armed with firearms hold their fire as long as possible to avoid signaling the offensive for the enemy. As the Draelic infantry move in, the response from the defenders is extremely gradual. In this formation, it would be possible for the team to slip through the Draelic ranks undetected by the enemy. All it would take is a bit of decent stealth. Of course, then you would be leaving a portion of the fighting to the soldiers, which you could otherwise take on. Gent says, "I'm always pro-stealth, but what would sneaking ahead accomplish? We could also attack them from behind." And Hex says, "Yeah, like on the one hand, I want to believe that the army came here prepared to fight, but on the other hand, why would we need to sneak ahead?" And I say, "Since you gained the assistance of the Drow Resistance and their guide, part of the battle plan includes a simultaneous strike on the outpost from the Underdark Passage located within. In addition, the main attack force is attacking at multiple points, such as the portion of the troops that will be heading for the gate with the bay here via the chasm. Between these multiple points of attack, it would be fairly simple to get into the outpost with the army without taking part in any of the initial direct fighting with Azers and Hellhounds. So, for example, you could proceed directly to the gate with the bay here, or to a similar objective that lies beyond this initial charge. If you want to try for this option, you must all make stealth checks. Hex looks over at Gent and says, shall we leave the grunt work to the grunts? And Gent says, is the tin can up for it? Connor grumbles indignantly as he casts Cat's Grace on himself. Gent says, cool, let's stealth. Gent gets 26. Connor casts Guidance on himself. Hex gets 29. And even with the Guidance and Cat's Grace, Connor gets 12. Together, they attempt to weave their way through the front lines toward an exposed point in the outpost perimeter. The first wave provides decent cover as they clash with the beleaguered Azar guards that patrol the outskirts of the outpost. Unfortunately, two such guards go out of their way to chase after you when you reach what was previously an open and unguarded point of entry into the outpost. The two Azar manage to catch up with Connor before he can get into the outpost, and the soldiers all around you are preoccupied with their own fights. We're going to have to roll initiative. So Gent gets a 16, Alex is classic. Hex 25, Connor 5. And I say, yep, had to get one last batch stealth in before the battle, even with Cat's Grace and a guidance. And so I say, evidently Paylor didn't approve of sneaking away from his comrades in arms. So it starts off with just these two Azar coming towards them, and they have like a pretty simple fight with just a couple of Azar. But as Connor lands the final blow, he looks up to see more enemies approaching from nearby. Two more Azar with a pack of four Hellhounds charging ahead of them. The Azar, slow to mobilize, were not able to bring their Hellhounds to bear against the attacking force right away, but now they are arriving, and the effect on the Draelic lines is devastating, as the Hounds can let out gouts of flame which slay multiple soldiers at a time. Again, maybe a good thing you didn't bypass this part of the battle in terms of limiting friendly casualties. So, a bunch of Hellhounds and Azar join the fight. They get more stymied outside the sort of entrance to the outpost. The Hellhounds surround Hexakila and Connor and like just sweep massive fire over both of them from either side. The two Azar handlers follow the dogs, moving to the space north of Hex to separate him from Connor. Connor squares up with the Azar to his south, then casts Divine Word. The Azar are returned to the elemental plane of fire in a brilliant beam of light from the heavens, and all the Hounds but one are suddenly dragged back to hell in a blaze of hellfire. Connor advances on the last Hound, takes a swim with his javelin. Connor stabs the Hound in the right front leg with his javelin. Stabbling javelin. The creature snarls in disgust.
Stabbling with the javelin.
Hex sees another couple of Azar incoming. And tries to open fire on one of the Hellhounds. Connor seizes the moment to say, ha, couldn't even take one out, eh? One day I'll show you how it's done. Hex hisses, shut up, Clanky. There's also a note here. Gent, at some point when it comes to their turn, says, sorry, was eating cheese. And I say, bah, eating cheese, the typical RPG excuse. And then when they get a 13 to hit, they say, the cheese ruined my aim.
Ugh, now that is a typical RPG excuse.
And they say, Dangus, the shadow bolt lands in the dirt, then dissipates in like a wisp of smoke. Meanwhile, Alex said that his girlfriend had Gouda, but there's not enough for me to have any without her noticing. And Shent suggested rolling for stealth, Alex. The two arriving Azar move into melee range with Connor and Hex, respectively. Connor managed to slay the Fiend Hound, but the other pair of Azar arrive, and then it's Hex's turn. I rolled a... Hex managed to hit one of the Azar with his Apollo laser pistol, and I rolled the target, and he gets shot in the groin. I say, in fire-ease, ah, my groin! Across the perimeter of the outpost, they see squads of soldiers enveloped in huge gouts of flame, screams echoing across the battlefield. The Hellhounds are clearly giving their army the most trouble. They take position near a rocky vantage point, which gives them a clear line of sight to a nearby squad that is fighting through Azers and Hellhounds, same as them. The Azer that moved up last turn takes a swipe at Hex with his Wakizashi, but Hex ducks it. The two Azer that just arrived move into position to engage Hex and Connor in melee. Two more Azer start to head over, recently freed up by a Hellhound charge that dealt with their opponents. To Gent's astonishment, however, they watch from their vantage point as Draelic forces push back, slaying the nearby charging Hellhounds in a heroic countercharge. There are no longer any Hellhounds nearby. They can see some gouts of flame in the distance that suggest there are some being deployed to other areas, but the Draelic forces nearest to them are presently safe from Hellhound attacks. So eventually they finally, manage to take out all these Azer and Hellhounds as they're coming through, you know, joining into the charge into the Ashgrain outpost. Connor actually ends up casting, divine word again. An Azer to Connor's side drags its Wakizashi up his left thigh. Connor takes a look down at his thigh and shouts divine word again. The Azer vanish in a shower of Paylor's light. All around them, the party can see the Draelic advance succeeding. The Azer are overwhelmed. Two more arrive to fight, but there are no engaged Azer left in sight beyond them as the Draelic army continues to push into the outpost. The remaining Azer races to try and intercept Hexakila as he moves towards the outpost, but all around you can see his fellow Azer are little more than ash and armor plating underfoot. Connor pulls out the Orion antimatter rifle, or sorry, not the Orion antimatter rifle, the Orion heavy sniper rifle. To take out the last Azer. And as I mentioned, I gave them their pay bonuses for the objectives up front. So they received 150 gold pieces each for fighting on the front lines. To give an example of how much they had at this point, Gent now has 19,404 gold pieces. At last, the sounds of Draelic gunfire ring out in earnest, not just from the perimeter of the outpost, but from within the outpost as well. Apparently, the Drow resistance has made good on their promise to lead soldiers in through the Underdark passages. Nearby, they spot beleaguered Azer guards rushing to respond to the assault, but they're far too spread out to mount an effective defense. As the Azer guards scramble, some to their garrisons and some into combat, their attention is drawn to the chaos and confusion of the slaves who have been caught in the opening rush. There are at least 60 frightened, hapless slaves in the immediate area, ranging from drones, some of which appear to have gone feral like the one you saw with the escaped slaves before, to goblins, to dwerger, to drow. There are even three stone giants among them. And everybody gets up to 303,975 XP. I tell them they can attempt to rally these many frightened slaves since the rest of the army is occupied, but you guys are free agents of a sort here. Since they're frightened, you could potentially intimidate them into fighting, but otherwise it'll probably be a persuade check. Gent rolls a 21 to persuade and says, "We helped you defeat the chains of slavery. Trust that we will defeat the chains of this." And Connor assists by yelling, "This is our Independence Day!" giving Gent advantage. Gent calls out the song of their people, who themselves were long oppressed under the rule of the Nightside Eclipse. Rallying the many different slaves together, they quickly add them to the allied attacking force. The slaves quickly make up for the numbers lost to Hellhounds in the initial charge, and even those losses were relatively minimal from a tactical standpoint. The battle is going well, and you just partially replenished your side's forces. Gent gives everyone a good game butt slap. I say the work songs of the Bone Song Kenku, the tribe has that name for a reason, bolster the resolve of the rebel troops. Before pressing further into the outpost, you notice distinct units moving along the front line, checking up with those too injured to continue pushing forward. Medics. These units are getting the attention of everyone they can in the area, including your team and any slaves caught in the chaos. They announce that they brought fresh supplies of treated brain caps. Anyone who can spare the time is advised to check in with one of these teams before moving on. Alex says out of character, 30 minutes straight of individual butt slaps. There is a lineup. And Gent says, the trick is to just run with your hand out. I say, you can all run hands out forward through a field of butts. Which is a reference to a Run the Jewels line. You can all run backwards naked through a field of dicks. So, the medic gives them a bandolier of small metal cylinders. Special delivery for your team. You get 6 treated brain caps. Try not to use them all today, and remember, it's not healthy to take more than one at a time. Good luck, agents. The medic offers a salute, and they each get 6 treated... There, they get 6 treated brain caps. AKA Brain Cap Plus. And, there's a little bit of, they dispense the brain caps amongst each other, so they each get 2 brain caps. Hex says they would have offered Gent the spider silk sling in to make up for the loss if necessary. I think it's magic or something, he says. And Gent says, fair. Now, Gent is happy they could persuade the Giants. Continued efforts to fight slavery or indentured servitude. This is in reference to the fact that Gent spent a number of diamonds to get the slave stone giants on their side. So Hex is basically saying, like, oh, well, since you had to spend those diamonds, I could give you a sling for your trouble. And she's like, nah. And says, also, I am filthy rich. And, I say, okay, I won't add the sling to Gent's sheet then. And Hex says, damn, that's almost like a character arc or some shit. The idea of Gent not receiving, like trinkets for their, trouble. But I pointed out, Gent's always been very anti-slave, even when it was Nightside Eclipse slaves, which, like, that's pretty big. Back in Citra Akra, when the Nightside Eclipse were being thrown into the Demon Colosseum, not anti-slave. And they laugh and say, yeah, fuck those slaves. Say, as you move amongst the advancing Draelic soldiers, you can spot the detachments that are breaking off to enter the outpost via the chasm. Staying at the edge before dropping into the outpost, you get a good vantage point to observe as the soldiers march through the passage leading toward the gate. The Bayhir emerges, scuttling out of a tunnel on one side of the passage to place itself between the advancing soldiers and the gate. It begins to crackle with electrical energy when suddenly a huge black shape swoops down from above and cloaks it in darkness. Cub has swept down and enveloped the beast in its wings. Lightning crackles out of the dark mass as Cub pushes down on the centipede-like monster with its crushing force. As the dragon appears to smother the Bayhir, Cub lashes its head forward and spews a black decaying torrent of necrotic energy downward into his quarry. As the mass of fuming scaly darkness tumbles to one side of the passage, stray lightning bolts flashing out occasionally between its wings, the Draelic army surges forward in an unstoppable tide toward the trench. The gate opens as if on command, failing to slow the Draelic assault in any way. And Gent shouts, you're welcome for unlocking it. Everyone gains 200 gold each. This bonus is gained automatically for their success in liberating Cub, effectively countering the Bayhir's presence. Having totally breached the outpost's first line of defenses, they may now more or less travel to any point in the outpost freely while the battle is raging. The nearest point of interest is a massive bridge connecting 2 of the upper levels to cut across one of the deep mining pits. According to their drow intelligence, there's a stream under the bridge leading out of the Underdark. This would be the passage where the drow resistance came through with the Draelic infiltrators. It may be prudent to check in on that point of entry before proceeding with the rest of the assault. And I included the map of Ashgrain Outpost once more. We're really going to have to, you know, at some point update the...
Yeah, I know. I'm falling behind. I got to do it.
Yeah, I was really glad you managed to find that guy who did that review's name earlier, because I was thinking, like, man, it's going to be ages before we get that guy's name up in the show notes.
Yeesh. Yeah, I keep all my bookmarks. I got everything from all the shows stashed away, but I don't know. I'll try to prioritize it over Christmas break. I just never think of it.
I think I've got the right links, like, organized, you know.
Oh yeah, I mean, we got them all in our Discord chat too.
Yeah. The Underdark Passage is under the big red block labeled Bridge, and Hex says, "Seems like we need to take the bridge and run Overwatch from there." And Gent says, "Bridge over Quiethus. Never saw it, but figured it's important." I say, "By the time you reach the area around the bridge, the bulk of the fighting has been pushed beyond this point. The bridge and the area below have been secured behind the ever-advancing mass of Draelic troops. The area beneath the bridge is dominated by rubble, through which the stream winds its way out of the nearby Underdark tunnel. The terrain is so uneven that it actually poses some difficulty to navigate without slipping and hurting yourself, especially with the water of the stream making some of the rocks slippery. Apparently, the forces that came through here made one hell of a push. You suspect explosives were involved." And I have everyone roll acrobatics. And I did establish that this is more than an hour since the first fight, which I believe is important for Connor's spellcasting. Descending into the pit below the bridge, Connor slips, falling prone amid the wet rubble, but not taking any damage. "Oh, pray to Paylor, guidance," Gent says, "Plinko." And I say, "You can avoid this pratfall with divine aid." And Hex says, "15 instead. Thanks, Paylor." Say, "Hey," Connor slips, but Paylor rights his step by casting a light across the wet stones. And he manages to find his footing without falling. Gent gives a little... investigating the area, you determine that the friendly forces that came through here have already moved on. However, you do spot a few drones and Dwager lingering in the area, apparently uncertain how to proceed in the wake of the recent events. They definitely seem scared. Jake gives a little frowny face, and Connor shouts, "We are the light! Dawn breaks over this hellish compound, and the shadows will flee before us." And he gets a 22 to persuasion. And Gent says, "Nice, Connor the Evangelist." And out of character, Alex said, "Only your monetary contribution can do the Lord's work. Please give generously." I'd say initially there are only a couple of drones and a couple of Dwerger wandering around, but as Connor gets their attention, one more of each comes out of hiding in the stream nearby. The stream is about 10 feet wide and about 5 feet deep. The drone and Dwerger that were hiding rise out of it, wet and dirty from lying prone in the stream. Drones and Dwerger seem to rally, taking hold of the situation rather than cowering as it unfolds. They head off to take advantage of their newfound freedom. Everyone gains 200 gold each for handling the drones and Dwerger under the bridge. The Gent says, "Man, just the sound effect of cha-ching, cha-ching," which reminds me of Fallout. Yeah, I mean, technically you get these bonuses paid out to you after the battle in recognition of your participation in each objective, but the three of you just added 66 more loyal bodies to the cause, and that's not even counting Cub, so you'll be rewarded substantially for your part in the battle. Once they pass the bridge, they come to the central area of the outpost where the fighting is thickest. A fort stands on a landing of high ground overlooking the rest of the outpost, and from this fort, the giants stationed there hurl massive rocks at the surrounding Draelic forces, which continue to flood into the outpost. With their stone giant allies leading the way, the spearhead of the Draelic army surges past the fort in an unstoppable tide of red cloaks, while detachments remain in place surrounding the fort behind them. The troops assaulting the fort could use some aid. Nearby, they see a stone giant slave in chains on the wall of the fort with a fire giant on either side of them. All three giants are hurling rocks into the surrounding attackers. And I have everyone roll insight. And Gent gets a nat 1. And I say, Gent slept through giant psychology specifically. But Connor gets a 25 and Hex gets a 22. I say, though the slave participates in the defense, you can see on their face that they're not happy about their situation. You suspect they would switch sides, but they would need to be liberated from the restraints in order to stand a chance against the guards on either side of them. The Hex says, seems like we got a priority prisoner to break free over there. Let's move. Gent says, someone call a locksmith? I say, this is your classic deal with the artillery position mission from ye old World War II game. And Hex says, except with jetpack insertion. I say, only the artillery is a giant. You have to unlock his chains instead of blowing him up. That too. And Hex says, although depending on the World War II game, Nazi super science maybe? And so that is where we break, is with them moving into position to liberate a stone giant from a couple of fire giants on either side of them. And that is where we broke, as they looked forward to ending the tyranny at Ashgrain Outpost.
Hell yeah. It's all been building to this. Well, lately.
Yeah, well, and now the battle is full on raging all around them, and they're like, they see a bunch of two giants ganging up on a stone giant and making them throw rocks, and they're like, that's an artillery position. We got to take that out.
Nice. Just like
taking out the big guns in a Call of Duty game with some C4, or not C4, but, you know, some explosive charges.
Heck yeah. I'd have more commentary on these big battles, but, like, we've talked about a lot of big battles and different ways of running them over the course of the show. I feel like I'd just be repeating myself. I think it's cool how you run big battles, like, not to use the phrase that we uttered before, but, like, boots on the ground style. Like, you really follow the, from the player's perspective. It's almost like that movie 1917. Whereas sometimes I find myself sort of zooming in and out as they change position and you know, play with scale a bit.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is that I've given them the opportunity to, like, jump from point to point in the battle. But they, like, in that, I mean, I guess it really came down to Connor's stealth check, is, like, they ended up being sort of, like, caught up in the initial charge. But, like, there is... You can, like, I've given you this map, and we have things like fort, prison camp, big huts. I mean, so some of these have been dealt with before, like the forge, mm-hmm. The prison camp, and I think to some extent the big huts, because that's where Gent brought the stone giants from. But then we've got the fort, the den, the armory, the keep, and they could theoretically be like, all right, let's move on to hit this place. But you're right, like, we did end up doing the narrative very much like in order as it would be happening in the battle. So I think helped, like, add to the momentum of it, really.
For sure. Yeah. Well, as I said, you know, it's like 1917. You're there with them as they wade through it all.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, this may have been around the time that I was starting to watch Band of Brothers and things like that.
Ah, yes, of course.
Certainly it was coming to my mind at this point. So do you have anything else? Oh, right, you have a goblin with a big ass.
It's a goblin with a fat ass, Tom.
Fat ass, right. And
here, I'm going to...
There was nothing else, right?
No, nothing else. So here, let's pop over to the RPG Danger Room to play... Goblin with a Fat Ass. Not me. But we're not actually going to play it this time. We're just going to go over the rules. Maybe it's a lot of dice rolling. A lot of it is randomly generated. It seems like this is designed to be picked up and played quickly. So we can at least generate some elements. What do you say?
Okay.
So get out your dice, and here's the pitch. You are a group of ne'er-do-wells with one goal, to rob the richest person in town blind. Unfortunately, or fortunately for you, you are each a goblin with a fat ass. So this is a game by Tom Bloom. It's designed for 2 to 4 players and a DM, which in this case stands for Disaster Master. The DM can also be a player. The DM describes a scene, plays the NPCs, asks the players what they will do, the players get up to various forms of goblin mischief, and the DM describes the outcomes based on their actions. To do anything, do it. Don't roll dice for everything. However, if something is contested or the outcome is unclear, you roll some dice. And we'll get into the rolling of those dice after we generate the setup, which is also on page one. And it just involves a series of D6 rolls. So, Tom, roll a D6.
Got a one.
So you and your fellow goblins with fat asses are going to rob the mayor. Roll again.
A six.
So the thing about the mayor, though, is that he lives in a luxurious mansion on the edge of a cliff. Roll again.
What are we robbing? A two.
So you are, you're breaking out an imprisoned greed demon who is very loud and complains a lot. The mayor has a greed demon imprisoned in the basement of his luxurious mansion on the edge of a cliff. Roll again.
They're protected by a cadre of numerous and poorly paid guards and... one.
Bloodthirsty, goblin-hating pirate mercenaries. So you goblins really have your work cut out for you. And one more time.
Whatever the green demon we're trying to rob, or no, this person is locked in, four.
So the greed demon that you're trying to free from its imprisonment is locked in a living vault embedded in a huge beast. Hey, that's awesome. I like that.
Oh, man.
That's pretty cool. So, like...
getting Orcstain vibes.
Yeah. So that's the setup. You and the other players are robbing the mayor. You're infiltrating his luxurious mansion on the edge of a cliff to steal an imprisoned greed demon who is guarded by guards and bloodthirsty, goblin-hating pirate mercenaries and locked in a living vault embedded in a huge beast. Hell yeah, I love that setup. That was great. So there are a few more mechanics on this first page, but they mostly pertain to how the game runs, and in order to play the game, you need a character. So pop over to page two, and we are going to roll up your character. This is, once again, just a series of dice rolls. You'll most of them D6s, but you will need a D8 when you come to roll for your class. Are you ready, Tom?
One of these is 0 to 7.
And I'll explain why.
Okay.
Also, here's a secret in the margin. If you like, roll a D6. If you roll a 1, you're actually a kobold instead, but don't tell the goblins.
I got 3.
Okay, so you're not a kobold. Now let's roll up your goblin. So once again, roll a D6.
I got 1.
So the first thing that you're rolling for is the size of your ass. Now, you can adjust your roll up or down by 1. That's why this scale goes from 0 to 7. And what this determines, the main role of the game is you're rolling ass. It's an ass roll. And the size of your ass determines how many dice you roll when you are asked to roll ass. So you got a 1, which means you have a firm handful of an ass. But
I can put it up to bubble butt.
That's right. Or you can put down to a shame to goblin kind.
I don't like that. I'll go with bubble butt.
So Tom is a bubble butt goblin. Now we determine how did you get your ass? And this determines some extra skills you have. You get skills from your class and then you get skills from your ass.
I got 1. I rolled a 1, so a life of leisure and indolence.
Yeah, you got your bubble butt because you just sat around, lazing about, enjoying a life of leisure, which means your character gets 3 skills, charisma, fashion, and wine tasting. This is one of those systems where if your skill applies to a check, You know, you happen to be at a winery, you're in the mayor's wine cellar, and you want to find the most valuable bottle of wine there. Well, you'd roll on wine tasting, and that means you roll two dice for your bubble butt and then an extra d6 for your wine tasting skill. Now we roll for class, which will give you additional skills and an ability. This one is a d8 roll.
I got a 3.
A 3. So you're a barbarian with a bubble butt. You get the additional skills of intimidation, athletics, and competitive eating. And
no, I don't like that.
And you have the ability where there's no penalty if you're dazed, and you can ignore being knocked out once. And then roll 1d6, and this determines your gear. The gear only lasts for one mission. This game seems to be designed for doing, like, one shots.
I got a 1.
So you have a fabulous hat, a stethoscope, tape, a screwdriver, and a bottle of orc liquor, which is antiseptic and possibly drinkable. So now you know how things are rolled. So if the outcome, if something is contested or the outcome is unclear, you roll a d6. On a 4 or more, you do it. On a 1 to 3, you don't, and you suffer the consequences. If doing it would be hard, you need to roll a 6 to do it to avoid consequences. What is hard and what is not is up to the DM, but should be fairly obvious. Now, you might get more or less dice. You roll an extra die if you have a skill. You roll an extra die if you have a situational advantage, like a tool or a convenient chandelier. You roll one less die if you're dazed. You roll one less die if the situation is bad, like you can't see or you're suspended over a lake of lava by one hand. And if any roll is reduced to 0, much like in something like Teeth, Blades in the Dark, you roll 2d6 and take the lowest. Now, if doing something is risky, which should be most of the things in the game, or it could cause mayhem, mischief, or general chaos, you also roll ass. To roll ass, you roll 1d6 per your goblin's ass size. If you have the 0 shame to goblin kind, you roll 2d6 and pick the lowest. If you get at least 1 6, there's a surprising upside, opportunity, or advantage. Multiple sixes means this is extra good. It applies even if you fail. If you roll at least 1 1, there's also a downside, an extra risk, complication, or injury. Multiple ones means that this is extra bad and can apply even if you succeed. These may or may not be ass-related. Ones and sixes cancel each other out. There is a clock that is also reminiscent of Blades in the Dark, the Chaos Clock. It is a 12-segmented clock. And each time players roll at least 1 1, they roll the number 1 on any final result of any ass roll, you fill in one segment of the chaos clock. This tracks generally how things are going. If the clock hits midnight and you run out of segments, shit hits the fan. You have to cut and run or try and make a mad dash, last bid for the prize, no exceptions. And I kind of like how the slices on the clock have a few labels. So you go around, at first everything is fine, and then it gets more intense. Everything is fine in bold and italic with an exclamation mark, and then finally on the midnight slice, it's get the fuck out of clock. It also says here, please respect the chaos clock. And then final note, as I mentioned before, if you fail rolls, there are consequences. So, oh no, someone's failed a roll, or rolled some ones on an ass roll. Time to do one or more of the following. Pay a cost. Inattention, a goblin is preoccupied for a while. Effectiveness, needs a little help from someone else to get the job done. Or danger, the situation gets more dangerous or tense. So the consequences are like, you're not paying attention, you're not very good, or there's some external danger coming up. Or you could smack someone. Daze a goblin or knock a goblin out, stooge style. A dazed goblin gets minus 1d6 to do anything, and if hurt again is knocked out.
Not me.
Goblins recover from being dazed after a scene is over. and then knocked out. A knocked out goblin must be carried around like a sack of pear-shaped potatoes and wakes up in the next scene as long as they make it out okay, are captured if they're left behind. It's pretty easy for a human of average strength to knock a goblin out with a big enough implement. Or there are two more options for consequences, or start a ticking clock. Write something bad down, like the lava gets released, the dogs are loose, the alarm is set off, someone's knocked out, the door jams, you lose control of the vehicle. The next time there's a fuck up in the same situation, it comes true, maybe the next time after that. So, you know, tick away the clock, again, similar to something like a Forged in the Dark game. And then finally, another consequence, escalate the situation. You either choose or roll 1d6. So, hey, roll that 1d6 one more time, Tom.
Four.
So you failed your ass roll, which means that you drop or lose track of something important. Maybe you drop.
It wasn't my ass.
It might be your screwdriver or your bottle of orc liquor. Now you don't have an antiseptic. So that is Goblin with a Fat Ass. And unlike most short, like two-page RPGs, I feel like this, like, you see what I mean? I think this is playable. I think this is, you could pick up and play this pretty quick. Generate a character. It's got a very basic system. A lot of Blades in the Dark influence, like you're pulling a heist, right? And there's a clock at the center of it all, and we're dealing with D6s for the most part. What do you think, Tom?
I don't know. I think, you know, it strikes me very similar as like a lot of these like two-page RPGs or sort of thing.
Oh, but I
you know, it really reminds me of Honey Heist. Do you know Honey Heist?
Yeah, I do know Honey Heist. We've talked about Honey Heist. That is a comparable one, I would say, for sure. I was going to object and say, like, you know, we covered all those Oliver Darkshire games, and I think this is at least more of an RPG than any of those.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah. But I thought this was fun. I thought this is a fun little thing. I like that they used the New Yorker font for the title of the game. And, like, this game does seem playable to me. I do think you could run at least one fun session of Goblin with a Fat Ass. If you got a party of people who are feeling rowdy, and it's one of those situations where, like, you were ready to play a game, but then two of the four players dropped out and couldn't make it. So what are you going to do? You can't play the campaign. Well, let's just run a fun session of Goblin with a Fat Ass. But yeah, I think Honey Heist is a good point of comparison there.
Yeah.
And here's one last note, Tom. I buried the lead with this one. I really did, because we're not going to cover it on this episode. We're going to cover it on next episode. Tom Bloom, who created Goblin with a Fat Ass, also created an itch.io RPG called Magna Gothica Malagast. Have you heard of this?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, buddy. I might be wrong. After all the things we've talked about with what settings and stuff appeal to you, I might be wrong on this. But this one really seems kind of like your jam. If you take a look at the artwork samples in the margin on the right there, I think this looks pretty dope, and definitely gonna cover this next time.
Like Ammo Goblin.
Yeah, I had a feeling you might like the Ammo Goblin. And look at the gore grinders. These guys look great.
Right. Well, that's for next time then, eh?
Yeah, it is. I was hoping to get your reaction, but it seems like stunned silence.
I don't know. I'm interested. Not as messy, but there's certain elements that remind me of Morkborg.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is almost like a cleaner version of Morkborg from what I've seen. But we'll dive into that more next time.
I like choose one of six great houses and raise the dead. I'm interested in learning about these,
Hell yeah.
And about these six great houses.
Figure out Ammo Goblins, Necromancy, the Houses of the Dead, Gore Grinders. Seems pretty metal. Seems like it could be cool. And for the low price of $6.66.
Nice. All right. Well, that's exciting. If you want to get in touch with us, see when we post new episodes or follow us, check us out on Comparing Campaign on Facebook. And if you want to see our show notes and supplemental materials once we get them up, it's comparingcampaign.wordpress.com.
Level up, get that ass.
You know, I haven't said this in a while, but, you know, use the whole meat.
Use the whole meat.
Use your whole goblin ass and use your whole, you know.
Your meaty goblin ass.
I was really thinking of Extreme Meat Punks Forever. Yeah. They really use the whole meat. So use the whole meat.
Use the meat punk. You know what else you haven't said in a while?
Don't steal because it's haunted.
That's right.
Yeah, you shouldn't steal. It's haunted.
Not me.
Take care, everybody.